Welcome back to the Talmud class.
Now, one matter of housekeeping, and that is that 2 weeks from tonight there will not be a class. 2 weeks from tonight is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and I'll be away. So there will not be a class the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Yes, next week, and yes, 2 weeks after that, but not the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Let's see, today is the 9/16/23. There will be no class on the 23rd of November. Okay? Now, again, for those of you who haven't purchased a book, I think that you'll be well served by purchasing the first volume of the Art School edition of the Tractate Sanhedrin. I note to you that most of the Art Scroll, not most, all of it, is available in two sizes. There's a large size and a small size. Some of you I see have a large size, some of you have a small size. And there's an advantage to each. The advantage to the small size, it's easy to carry. The advantage of a large size is that it's easy to read. So whether your strength is in carrying or reading, that should determine the size that you get. The price is not very different, although it's a little different, I think, between them. Okay? Then the announcement was 2 weeks, there's no class. Okay? Wednesday before Thanksgiving, no session. Now, a few final remarks of introduction, and that is that the Tractate of Sanhedrin appears as one of the central tractates of the order of Nezikin. Now we said that in the Mishnah there are six orders, Shisha Siddarim, Shas, Shisha, Shin, Siddarim, Samach, Shisha Siddarim, and there is the fourth order, is the order of Nezikim. Nezikim, in general, refers to simply laws of damages, but it really means the civil, the criminal law in its totality. Now, that having been said, we, in this Talmud class a few years ago, studied the first of the tractates of the order of Nezikim, and that was Baba Kama. Baba Kama. There was Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Batra, and then comes Sanhedrin in the order of things. Okay? Now, in some of the editions of rabbinic literature, among them, for example, in the edition of the Tosefta, which is a contemporaneous, a collection of rabbinic material which is contemporaneous with the Mishnah, okay, edited just about the same time the Mishnah was edited, the Tosefta. The Tosefta calls Nezikin the three tractates of Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, and Baba Batra. Baba Kama means the first gate. Baba Metzia means the middle gate. Baba Batra means the latter gate. Okay? So those were the three gates of Nezikin, and they were apparently called, at least in some compilations, Nezikin, damages. What we understand Nezikin to be is the title of one of the entire orders, which goes beyond those three. Probably at one time there was a very large tractate which included all those three tractates, and that was called Nezikin. The tractate that followed that was a tractate called Sanhedrin. Interestingly enough, the tractate of Sanhedrin included more than we have in our tractate Sanhedrin. It also included the tractate that follows Sanhedrin, which is Makot. Makot literally means lashes. In fact, it's referring to lashes. And Makot are the punishments of the court. The punishments of the court. It also deals with a certain amount of judicial procedure. But that was apparently all one tractate. And we have this from certain manuscripts where these things are all defined as Sanhedrin. By the time we get to any printed editions of the Talmud, remember that the Talmud is printed for the first time at the end of the 15th century. Right around the time that printing develops in Germany, when you have the Gutenberg Bible, printing develops simultaneously in Italy. And in northern Italy, you have the first printed Jewish books done by the firm of Sanchino. Sanchino. Okay? So Sanchino goes to northern Italy. It was set in type by a man named Bamberg, who very likely was a Gentile. And Gentiles in that particular era of time were well versed in Jewish studies. Anyone who was an intellectual, people like Vico, people who were masters of the Renaissance, also knew Hebrew, and frequently they would know Aramaic. There were those who specialized in, for example, Zohar in the mystical texts, others who were interested in law. Okay, so the format that we have of things really dates at least from Bamberg in that period, right around 1500. Okay, now if you take a look in our text, the very beginning of the Sanhedrin text, remember that every tractate of the Talmud begins on page 2. So the first page of the text is 2A. 2A. Talmud goes according to the Daf and the Amud. Daf is the folio, and side A and side B. Side A and side B. So you have folio B, side A and side B. Of course, every tractate begins with page 2. Why does it not begin with page 1? Because there is no beginning. You have to know everything comes before, and you always pick up later on.
Same as Bereshit. It's like there's no 13th floor in the building.
Well, I don't know if it's the same, but
Bereshit also begins with a Bet.
Correct. Bereshit begins with Bet. You would never begin with Aleph, because that's beginning at the beginning, and there is no such thing as a beginning. Everything is continuous, okay? So the Talmud always begins with page 2. So every tractate is the same. It doesn't make any difference. The pagination of the Talmud, by the way, is standard, and it became standardized as a result of Bamberg's printings. Once the Talmud was printed with a printing press, there were standard paginations. And though they varied a tiny bit, essentially what we have today is the way the Talmud was printed from about the year 1500. It was just about a year and a half ago that we had this wonderful exhibit at Sotheby's, where the Valmadonna exhibit at Sotheby's, which had those original Talmuds, several of the volumes. Excuse me? Yes.
Correct.
It was purchased by Henry VIII. The reason that we don't have many of these, of the original printings of the Talmud, because the church, in order to put the Jews in their place, burned all the Talmuds, because they felt that the Talmud was against the church. So if Jews owned the Talmuds, they were burned by the church. The only way that we have the original Talmuds that were published was because of Henry VIII. Henry VIII ordered an entire edition of the Talmud because he learned that the Talmud contained the laws of divorce. And since he was seeking to get divorced, he sent his scholars to the Talmud to figure out some grounds for divorce. So it was as a result of that crazy anomaly that we today have the Bamberg Talmud, which is in this Valmadonna collection. It's just totally bizarre, but this is the story of Jewish life.
The story that they told is that by the time it got printed and sent to him, he had already done right. away with the wife.
He had already
so
killed her.
So it's like, it's not even cracked.
Right.
They are pristine because
right.
they didn't really
yeah, they didn't have to use them at that point. Thank you for completing the story. Okay.
They weren't curious?
What?
They weren't curious?
Not at all. Not at all. It was a Jewish thing. They had no interest in it. It's
very
practical. Yes.
The printing history and the organizational outline that you gave, does this apply to Talmud and Yerushalmi as well?
No, Yerushalmi is not printed until much later. Until much later. Well, I don't know exactly the date, but it's later, because your Yerushalmi, standard printing of Yerushalmi was in Venice, and I believe it's about 1570 or something like that. It's about 100 years later, if that's much. I'm not sure whether it is or not. But that is then printed later. One of the tremendous advantages, well, keep in mind that the Babylonian Talmud was the most studied of the Talmuds. We have two. We have the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Babylonian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud became the standard for the production of law. Okay? And that was because in the Muslim world, there was a center of that world. The center of that world was in Baghdad. It was in Baghdad. It was not in the land of Israel. The land of Israel essentially had been destroyed as a political center in the Roman period. Romans destroyed Jerusalem, they destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem really never, the Crusaders wanted Jerusalem, the Arabs wanted Jerusalem, but Jerusalem was never a major center after the destruction of the temple until, frankly, 1967. 1967 is really the beginning of the resurgence of Jerusalem as a center for any group. It's not a center for the Muslims. I mean, it was a town, but it was not a major place. And that's true also for the Christians, although the Christians valued it for its own reasons. But the political center was in Baghdad. There were really two political centers in the Muslim world. One was Baghdad, and the other was in Cairo. Okay? And sometimes there was just the center in Baghdad, and sometimes there were these two poles in the Muslim world. But what that really meant practically was that there was a continuity of Jewish courts in Baghdad, which dated back to the time of the Talmud, because the rabbis of the Talmud were the same. They lived in the same place as did the later caliphs under Islam. Now, Islam doesn't come on the scene until the end of the seventh century, or the seventh century. The Talmud is already somewhat in the form in which we have it by about the year 500, so that's the 6th century. Okay. And nonetheless, the Talmud then becomes usable because of transportation. Anytime anyone had a question in North Africa, it would go to the Muslim scholars in Baghdad. So all of your whole society was set up to send things there. That gave the rabbis in Baghdad tremendous power. And there was for a while in the 10th century, there was competition between the rabbis in Israel who wanted to reestablish the land of Israel as a center of Jewish jurisprudence, and it never worked. It really never worked. It didn't. The only time that has worked, frankly, is in modern times. Jerusalem has again become the center post-67. It took till after 1967 for this to happen again. Even Take a look. Jewish history is fascinating when you look at books. That the Talmud above Dan's, the Dan's head. Dan is high, but the Talmud is even higher than he is. That one over there, right? The one with the red binding. That Talmud, he bought in Or Zarua. That was 1989. First purchase I made. I wanted the first purchase for the congregation to be a Talmud. So this was bought in memory of Dr. Albert Cornell, whose daughters were members of the congregation, and they were some of our original people. That Talmud that you're looking at was the last edition of the Vilna Talmud published in America. I had no idea at the time. I never would have imagined it. But that is the last edition of the Vilna Talmud published in America. subsequent to that Talmud, the only Talmud that's been published in America is the Art School, which is a totally different experience. It's an English, you know, stuff like that. But a classic edition of the Talmud, which we, when I was in rabbinical school in the 60s, we assumed, you know, everybody knew. You wanted to get a good Talmud, you got one that was published in Brooklyn or the Lower East Side. Because the American Talmuds were published with good paper, and they had good bindings. The Israeli Talmuds would fall apart. They were not well published. All of that has changed. Today, nothing like that is published in America. It's all published in Israel. There's been a tremendous shift of the community, which you can see in the books. Okay? Yes?
Since last Wednesday, after we read biblical verses, I wonder if there is any teaching or discussion in the Talmud or any other place about the issue of law, Jewish law, that the first guy who really imposed on Moses to do so was Yitro, who wasn't even Jewish or Hebrew. He was his father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And in another sentence, it says that it looks like Moses didn't have even a clue where he was going, because he said, "Where the shame will tell you." It's only 1,000 years later that Jerusalem became Jerusalem because of David. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if there is any, the two issues that Moses, key issues for Jewish, were completely unknown at that time.
Well, you'll see, even in this period, this piece that we're going to read tonight in the Mishnah, we see the origin of the court of 71, and that goes back to Moses. And in fact, it goes really back to Jethro, to his father-in-law, and to God's recommendations. It's really a combination of work between God and Jethro. But Moses is he's simply following instructions of people who know a lot more than he does, which are his father-in-law
and he was a Bedouin.
Above. Who?
Yitro
was a Bedouin.
Correct.
He knew what he was doing.
No law at all.
Well, I wouldn't say that, because he seems to know what he was doing. He knew what he was. Let's wait till we get there, because that'll be in the text. We'll see that in the text. Okay? Now, in the Bamberg printing of the Talmud, which is what you have here in the Art Scroll on your Hebrew side of the page, okay? The Bamberg printing of the Talmud, our classic printing, today we call, you don't call it Bamberg, it's called the Vilna printing. Because the last type that was set for Talmuds, according to the way Bamberg originally set it up, but the last time that was done was in Vilna. Right? In Vilna, this was done before World War One. After World War One, you had that done in Vilna. Since then, a Talmud has not been set in print with hard type. The modern Talmuds are not done with hard type, they're done all by computer. But the way Bamberg set it up, and the way the Vilna Shas is set up, is that the Talmud is in the center of the page. That's in the center. Immediately to the side, which is always on the side of the binding in the page, always next to the binding, but immediately adjacent to the Talmud text, is the commentary of Rashi. Rashi, remember, lived 1040 to 1105 in France. He's a Frenchman. And his commentary is vital to the understanding of the Talmudic text. Without Rashi, we really can't go anywhere. Okay? And every subsequent commentator really is totally dependent upon the Rashi. Now, having said that, of course, as soon as Rashi finishes his commentary, nobody agrees with him. Or somebody has something to add to what he says. So this is a group of Jews, you know, and it's never been any different. It's true in the Talmud, it's true in Talmud commentary. On the opposite side, here on the first page here, it's a very small commentary up here. That's the commentary of Rashi's grandchildren, by and large, and the generation of his children and grandchildren. That is called Tosafot. Tosafot. The Tosafot are additions, like Musaf, same word. Right? What is it a Tosafot to? It's the Rashi. It's an addition. It's an adding something to Rashi's commentary. Rashi is a very succinct commentary. Tosafot is an extremely verbose commentary. Rashi gives you just a few words to explain what the text is saying. Tosafot will start going, if you say this, and if you say that, but you could have said it this way, why did he say it? That's the Tosafot. Rashi will never do that. If you ever see Rashi doing that, you know that somebody has rewritten the Rashi. Because that's not the way he wrote. Rashi wrote clearly and precisely. That, and you always know that it's Rashi. Anytime that it doesn't read that way, it's been doctored. It's been doctored. Now, with that in mind, I just want you to take a look at the first Tosafot in Sanhedrin. Right? Now, you go here. The first Tosafot is now on the left side of the Talmud page. Dinei mamonot bishlosha. The laws of monetary courts are bishlosha of three people. Now that will be the first piece of the Mishnah, and we'll read it shortly. But I want you to see what the Tosafot say. Achar sheshana dinin bitlata babe. After the Talmud has taught dinim, laws, taught the laws. Now, the laws here means the civil laws, the civil law. Bitlata babe, in the three babas, referring to Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, and Baba Batra, those three gates, which were the previous three tractates, after it has taught us all these details of the civil law, Mashmi'enu bechama danim otam. The Talmud now comes to teach us with how many people one judges those laws that we have learned in the previous three tractates. Okay? So here the Tosafot simply come to explain now why Sanhedrin follows the three babas. Okay? So the three babas first with the civil law. After you have discussed a lot of the details of the law, now you need to know how do you in fact make the law function. So you have to know about the courts. Okay, and that's where we are here. Questions? Let's go to the text. Let me see. No, one more thing to read to you. One more thing. That is, again in the historical perspective now, Rashi is the 11th century. 1040-1105. Okay? Commenting on the Talmud, which is two pieces, the Mishnah in the year 200 CE, the Gemara in the year 500 CE, roughly. Okay? Rashi is then 11th century. A century later is the commentary of Maimonides. Rashi lives in France. Maimonides, well, got started in Spain, but his commentary was really written in Egypt. Okay? He writes some of his commentaries. The commentary on the Mishnah is written in North Africa, in Fez, in Morocco. The Mishneh Torah, which is his, as you lawyers would call it, the hornbook, the summary of the law according to the way Rashi read, Maimonides read it, that you find in the Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah. Maimonides was a great scholar, and the Mishneh Torah was published in 1179 in Cairo. And this in itself is many volumes. He entitles it Mishneh Torah. Now, any of you know the phrase Mishneh Torah is used also to refer to the book of Deuteronomy. The rabbis call Deuteronomy Mishneh Torah, and literally it means the second Torah, because Deuteronomy is a summary of the law. So Maimonides, in his humility, no doubt, calls his compilation the second Torah. Okay, it is the Mishneh Torah. Okay. Now, the last volume of the Mishneh Torah are Hilchot Shoftim, the laws of judges. Maimonides' purview of the law is all-inclusive. It is all-inclusive. Now, this is going to be important as the next few things I'm going to say. Much of Jewish law does not appear in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is the standard code of Jewish law of the 16th century. That is written by Rabbi Yosef Karo in Sfat, in the land of Israel, in roughly 1560. Okay? It includes limited areas of law. Namely, the first major portion of the Shulchan Aruch is Orach Chaim. Orach Chaim literally means the way of life. It's the ritual law. It's the entire corpus of Jewish ritual law. Okay? You have Yoredeah next. Yoredeah are the laws of Kashrut and the laws of mourning. Those are Yoredeah. And then there's Ebenezer. Ebenezer are marriage laws. Okay, the laws of marriage. You don't have major areas of the law, such as laws of judges in the Shulchan Aruch. There's some mention, but not a great deal. Not a great deal. Maimonides includes everything. All the areas of law, whatever is in the Torah, whatever is in the Talmud, Maimonides includes it. Keep that in mind. He begins Sefer Shoftim, the Book of Judges, in the following way. Mitzvat Aseh Shel Torah. It is a positive commandment of the Torah. Limanot Shoftim V'Shotrim, to appoint judges and magistrates, whatever that word Shotrim means, as I said to you last time, in modern Hebrew, Shoter means a policeman. B'chol Medina U'Medina. In every... I don't know what Medina means. What?
Medina in Arabic, which was the towns.
Correct. Very likely that this doesn't mean what we would say in modern Hebrew, every state. Probably does not mean that. It might mean province. You know, we don't know exactly what a town means. Ubechol plach uflach. Plach uflach means every small town, every town.
Now that could be a district or a region.
Not in Maimonides. Because you're starting with a larger, which is a Medina, going to the smaller, which is the Plach. Shenemar, as it says, and this is what we read last time, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'chol sharecha. Okay? You shall have judges and magistrates through, you shall make in all of your gates. Shoftim elu hadayanim. When we say judges, this is referring to dayanim, judges. Hakavuim bevet din, uvale dinim bayim lifnehem, which are fixed in a bet din, in a court, and the litigants come before them. Shotrim, when the Torah says shotrim, elu bale makel uretzu'ah. They are the ones who have the stick and the lash. Vehem omdim lifnei dayanim, and they stand before the judges, umisavavim bishevakim, and they go through the market, ubirachovot, and the streets, v'al hachanuyot, and the stores, litaken hasharim v'hamidot, in order to make things sure that things are done properly. They are regulating things. They are making sure that the weights and measures are of the storekeepers are accurate. Okay? Ulahakot kol ma'avet v'chol ma'aseihem al pi adayanim. And they are there to punish all of those who are perverting the law by their deeds, by virtue of the rule of the judges. V'chol shiyir ubo ivut davar mevi'in oto levedin. Anybody who is engaged in injustice is brought before the court. V'danin oto kefirisho. And he is judged according to his wickedness, his evil deed. Ein anu chayavim lahamid batei dinim b'chol plach uflach u'b'chol ir v'ir, ela be'eretz Yisrael bilvat. It is not obligatory to set up courts in every plach uflach, whatever that is, and called ir v'ir, in every town, except in the land of Israel. Aval b'chutz la'aretz. But outside of the land of Israel, einan chayavim la'amid bet din b'chol plach uflach. It is not obligatory to set up these courts in every jurisdiction. Shenema, because remember it says, titein lecha b'chol sha'arecha asher Hashem alokecha noten lecha lishvatecha. That's what we read last time. You shall place these judges in all of your gates, which the Lord your God shall give to you to your tribes. That specifically is referring to the land of Israel. Okay. So in fact, the legal justification of courts is different outside of the land of Israel than it is inside of the land of Israel. Okay? Now, connected with this one other fact that I want you to keep in mind. And that is that when people read Sanhedrin, they often read it the way you would study the legal procedure or the structure of the court system in this country. Well, that came natural. Why wouldn't you read it that way? For the following reason. You need to keep in mind some historical facts. And that is, we need to ask ourselves the question, if we are reading law that dates from the end of the 2nd century in the Mishnah, the subsequent 3 centuries in the Gemara, the question that we need to ask ourselves is, was this really a functioning system? Was this a functioning system? Let me tell you the implications of that. When the Romans moved into the land of Israel, and in fact take over all jurisdiction in areas of criminal law in the first century. Well, how do I know that that happened in the first century? Because of Easter. It's the Christmas and Easter story. We know that very basic to Christianity is a discussion of how it was that Jesus was convicted. And we know that basic to that was the place of Pontius Pilate and the Romans, and essential to our understanding of the stories in the New Testament is some notion of the level to which there was jurisdiction in capital cases to a Jewish court. And in fact, all scholars really know that by that period in time, that period in time means the first century. First, Jesus is the first century. By that period in time, Jewish courts had no jurisdiction.
But the Sanhedrin was still in existence.
That's what you think. That's what you think.
Pinchas was the head of the Sanhedrin.
What kind of Pinchas was the head of the Sanhedrin? I am just raising to your level of consciousness, we need to take all of this into account when we read what we are going to read. Because the temptation of the reader, as I said, is to assume that this is describing an actual reality. What we know is that to a very great extent, certainly as far as jurisdiction goes, there was no jurisdiction in most of the areas that we're going to read about. Now that's true, because I think it is true, then we have two possibilities. One, what we are reading about is a recollection of what it used to be like before the time came when the Romans came in and took away that jurisdiction. That could be one possibility. Or another possibility is that we are reading a combination of reality and something like wish fulfillment or fantasy. It's one thing to read about a legal system as it functions, and you read it and you assume that this is exactly the way it worked, when, of course, it didn't work that way. We know that these courts had no jurisdiction. Okay? Now, I think that's important to remember. Because when you get to something like Sanhedrin, Maimonides includes this in his compilation of the law in the Mishneh Torah, because he is all-inclusive. Rabbi Yosef Karo never does, because this is irrelevant. In fact, it doesn't really affect life. Jews have to know about tefillin. They have to know about whether a chicken is kosher. But, in fact, there were no courts, or very few courts. There may have been here and there a court, but for a very, very, very long time, including the time about which we are reading, these courts had no jurisdiction, or they had minimal jurisdiction. So I think it's always important to keep that in mind, to see whether what we are engaging is an intellectual exercise or a practical exercise. Now that is true for most of you who have been in law school. When you are involved in the law school kind of give and take, on the one hand, it's an intellectual exercise. On the other hand, if you're a lawyer or if you're a judge, you know it's not just an intellectual exercise, a very practical exercise. So I want you to keep that in mind as we read this material. One of the purposes of a tractate like Sanhedrin is perhaps not exactly what we might have thought it was, which is to tell us how the courts functioned, but instead it is in a way a compilation of history, reality, and sometimes philosophy, or thinking about how things should be. I had, for example, the rabbi who taught me Sanhedrin, my first teacher of Sanhedrin, he was very adamant about this. He himself was a strong believer in capital punishment. This was his own personal belief, that it was very important to have capital punishment in society. And he was well aware of the fact that the Talmud essentially outlaws capital punishment, even though the Torah not only legislates it, but it's all over the place. The Talmud outlaws it. So he used to say to us as follows. He would say, of course they outlawed it. They never had jurisdiction. As long as you don't have to deal with a capital case, it's very easy to say, we could never do such a thing. If you actually had to have a court that had to deal with something, you would have had a different product. Okay? And that had to deal with his own view of the subject. But when he taught us the material here in the Talmud, it was his contention that it had nothing to do with reality, and it simply was an expression of rabbinic values and should not be attached to reality. Yes.
Steinfeld, in his book Introduction to the Talmud, said that in Babylonia, okay, if I remember correctly, the Jews lived in relatively nice communities and took care of their own affairs. And Babylonians and then the Persians, pretty much left them alone in order to do that. So why wouldn't this be a reflection of the reality?
Because I don't know what he means by that when he says they left them alone. Does that mean they could try a capital case?
I don't know what he means either.
Does that mean that if there was a conflict between the laws of monetary matters, the laws of contracts, between the Babylonian courts, because Jews didn't only function by themselves. They always functioned together with the people around them. It's the only way you could have an economy. So if there was a conflict between the Jewish law and the law of the Persians or the Babylonians, there had to be a way to deal with these things. Okay? So I think that, yes, there is a certain amount of autonomy.
Well, not only autonomy, but isolation.
Isolation as well. And it's true, frankly, right up until the modern period. You take the Pale of Settlement, where Jews lived, they were isolated. Right? Jews could not live outside of certain areas, or Jews were required to live in ghettos. Right? So there was a clear geographical isolation. It's true and it's not true. I mean, yes, there is a certain degree to which it's absolutely true, of course. But what intercourse did people have with the societies around them, and how, in fact, were disputes settled? What jurisdiction did a Jewish court have in Poland, okay, or in Germany, or in Italy? The Jews could never try anybody in an Italian court, even though they had to be separate. So that within their own internal lives, they could have commerce based on certain rules that were theirs. But there were great limitations to that. Keep in mind also that the fact that there was a common Jewish law of monetary transactions was crucial in the development of the European economy. You know this story. Dr. Finkelstein, Louis Finkelstein, published these two, three volumes called The Jews, where he, this was done, I would be 1766, so this must have been published early 60s. Finkelstein put out this collection, which was a compilation of a lot of articles, which he put together. And one of the articles was on the history of the Jews in forming the modern European economy. And it was a fascinating thing to read about, because what he demonstrated was that the Jews were crucial for the development of European capitalism. Why? Because the Jews were the only group of people that had any degree of common law. If a small German principality wanted to trade with somebody in England, how did they do it? On what basis were your contracts mutually understood? At a certain point in the development of that, the only group of people that had a common law were the Jews. And the Jews lived in all of these places because they were forced to live in all of these different places. So that in the history of the development of the common law, the Jews played a crucial role. Not that, in fact, the common law was Jewish law. I'm not saying that. But in terms of the process of development, the Jews played a key role in that because they had this common law and because they lived everywhere. And they therefore were crucial for the development of commerce as Europe came out of feudalism and moved to a capitalist economy.
Well, if the Talmud really began, Mishnah 200 BCE...
CE. Mishnah is CE, right. 200 CE. That answers the question? Okay. I don't know what the question was, but the answer was good.
If it was earlier, then why weren't there the courts? Because
yes, because it's 200 CE.
Okay,
so 200 CE, the Roman destruction was in 70.
Right.
So the Mishnah itself dates from 130 years after the Romans had already come in and destroyed everything. Okay, that's the fascinating thing here. So that while I think you have a continuity of the ritual law, that doesn't matter who, well, it did matter a little bit because the Romans tried to destroy that too, but that really had much more continuity than did the civil and the criminal law. Okay? Yes.
On the question of jurisdiction in a capital case involving Jesus, Christians say the Jews are responsible for Jesus' death because the Gospel says he was tried in a Jewish court. On the other hand, the Jewish judges knew that their decision didn't carry any weight, right? So they then had to refer the case to a Roman court, even though they had come, sorry, kind of ad hoc way in the gospel.
This is a subject that has been well studied in the last 30 years, the last 40 years. It's a major piece of Jewish and Christian scholarship in order to clarify this. I'm just saying that this is not our subject per se, but it has ramifications on the way we will read this first issue.
I want to say, that system is not so unusual. We have had, in our time, societies that had institutions like legislatures that existed and that passed laws which were only, I don't know why, because all those rules and laws were already predetermined by the people who really owned the power. So the Soviet, but they didn't actually have anything to say. So
it's an interesting
maybe
study.
In Jewish, I don't know much about it, maybe in those days, in order to maintain a kind of peace, you allow a group to maintain its institutions, at the same time, you know, and they know, that it's strictly pro forma. So they have the feeling of being an intact social, political, religious group. At the same time, you know, you have all the power. And it's okay. They don't cause you trouble, you don't cause them trouble, as long as you respect each other.
This is a perfectly reasonable idea. I think it's a good idea. It's just to realize that that situation continued for at least about 1900 years. Almost 1900 years. After a while, you lose your illusions. After a while, you realize, well, I'm really powerful. That's the thing.
It makes life livable.
It makes life correct.
You can tell your children, I voted today. Come with me.
Now, the reason that I wanted to go into all of this was to provide background and context. And when you see this first Mishnah, there are some very odd things about the Mishnah. First of all, it's so long. This is a very, very long Mishnah. We have never seen a Mishnah anything like this. Number one. Number two, this Mishnah is an entire survey of Jewish law. When we get down to the nitty-gritty of this thing, I think that you will see that suddenly you have had an introductory course to the entire corpus of the law. I'd like to suggest before we read it that maybe that's the purpose of the Mishnah, is in fact to give you an introduction to the entire corpus of the law. And that is its purpose. It's not secondary to its purpose. It's not something that we might think, but in fact that's what it's all about. Let's look at the Mishnah. Okay? Dine mamonot bishlosha. Gzelot v'chabalot bishlosha. Nezek v'chatzi nezek tashlumi keifo v'tashlumi arba'a v'chamisha bishlosha. Ho nezter mefateh v'motzi shem ra bishlosha divrei Rabbi Meir. V'chachamim omrim motzi shem ra b'esrim u'shlosha mibnei sheyesh bo dinei nefashot. Okay, go back to the beginning. The Art Scroll is really wonderful, the commentary. I highly recommend going through and reading on the English side of the page. What the Art Scroll does is to both integrate a very short English commentary together with a footnoted longer commentary. And the longer commentary is usually based on Rashi. Not always, but it's usually based on Rashi. So that if you want to read the Rashi is here, it's on the Hebrew side of the page. But if you want to read the essence of the Rashi, you can simply read along, and most of the notes that you have in the Art Scroll are based on that. So, dine mamonot are monetary cases. Okay? Much of law deals with monetary transactions. And monetary cases are tried in a court of three. remember that last time we noted that there were three types of courts. One was the court of three, one was the court of 23, and one was the court of 71. Okay? So monetary cases are tried in courts of three. Nezek v'chatzi nezek. Nezek is full damages. Full damages. Chatzi nezek, half damages. Now, those of you who were in the class when we studied Baba Kama, remember that we study the laws of full and half damages. What is the law of full and half damages? This is the law of Shor Shenagach. If you have an ox who gores, this is the ox who gores. The ox who gores, if this ox gores, and it's the first time that the ox gores, you never had this ox doing anything like that, therefore we cannot assume that the owner of the ox should necessarily anticipate the actions of an ox. Most oxen don't gore on a regular basis. Okay? So if by chance this ox happens to go and happens to gore into your ox and causes a certain amount of damage or breaks down your threshing machine, okay, then we hold the owner responsible, but not fully responsible, because in a way, it's the ox's fault. But, well, was the owner negligent, and therefore we can consider him to be completely responsible? No, the owner was not negligent, because the first time it happens. The second time it happens, it's again chatzi nezek, half damages. The third time it happens, it's chatzi nezek. If it happens again, that owner is responsible. Okay? Because it's just a certain amount that you can attribute to the ways of an ox. At a certain point, you got to learn from your ox. Right? So that the Torah sets that up. So let us say that you have a case. There are several issues to be decided when you have a case of either half damages or whole damages. Number one are the facts of the case. Is this really a case where the ox has gored for the fourth time or the third time? Right? If I were the person who's been damaged, I would prefer it to be the fourth time, because then I get full damages. So if there was a case in the meantime that, you know, I'll have my lawyer say, oh, this, don't you remember this ox gored another time? Okay. So on the one hand, it's to establish the facts of the case that we will need judges. On the other hand, it is to establish the parameters of the damages. That's the key issue here. What is the damage worth? And the court has got to define how much the damages are in order to assess the responsible parties. Those kinds of decisions will be made by a court of three. Okay? Tashlume kefel, v'tashlume arba'a v'chamisha b'shlosha. There is such a thing as twofold compensation. Twofold compensation. Okay? Or there is compensation of four or five times the amount. What are we talking about here? Here we are talking about a theft. Somebody steals your sheep. No, not your sheep. He steals your television. Okay? They didn't have televisions, but he steals your television. It's easier to think this out. Some object steals your television. Right? So he's got your television. Now, I come and I say, you stole my television. He said, it's not your television, it's my television. I need a court in order to be able to prove that it's my television and not his television. Okay? Number one. Number two, according to the Torah, in a case of theft, where the object is still there, and we can establish that one person has committed the theft against another person, on the one hand, if the object still exists, we require the thief to return the object that still exists to the person who is rightfully the owner of the object. Right? But the Torah also requires compensatory damages. Whatever the value of that television is, the thief has got to pay, in addition to giving back the television, he's got to pay an equal amount of money as a penalty. As a penalty. Okay? So that's in the case where the television still exists. The Torah then...
The television doesn't exist, you just need to give it twice.
Well, that's correct. There it gets more complicated. If we have things that are really more valuable in an agrarian society than a television, like a sheep or an ox, then it gets more serious. Okay? And in fact, if what we are talking about is not only the return of the sheep or the ox, but the sheep and the ox has been slaughtered in the meantime, right? And then we penalize the person times four, or for an ox times five. Okay? Torah is very strict about that. Because these are really very damaging thefts. And if you allow that to go on in the society, a society that's based on the use of those animals can't function. Okay? So there is particular punishment for those things. So that's the four and the five. Again, facts of the case, as well as the amount of money that is due in each of these cases, will be decided by a court of three. Okay. Let's see, Chazik, did we skip any? Oh, yes, we did. Gezelot v'chavalot b'shlosha. That was the general case of theft. Chavalot, that's what I wanted to look at. Chavalot are injuries. You cause an injury to someone else. Now, in the American system, you call that torts, right? Injury? Injury is called a tort. Okay? So you cause an injury. Now, what does the Torah say about injuries?
Eye for an eye.
An eye for an eye. And a tooth for a tooth. Petza being called petza. An injury for an injury. Okay? And a life for a life. All right? Now, naturally, if you read the Torah and you see that, you wonder what it's talking about. According to the Talmud, it's very simple what it's talking about. It simply means appropriate compensation. In no way does it mean that you can provide an injury to somebody else in response to an injury that that person has caused you. Basic to Jewish law is the idea in torts, that torts is entirely a matter of monetary compensation. Monetary compensation. Okay. So that, on the one hand, is not intuitive if you simply read the text.
Why is that?
Because that's the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai. Right? That's what the Talmud says. This is Halacha Moshe Min Sinai. This is what God, right from the beginning, when he said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, what God meant by that was that it had to be appropriate compensation. Never could it ever have meant that you provide an injury to an injury. Okay?
That's the oral Torah?
That's the oral Torah, correct. The oral Torah. And the oral Torah, remember, is necessary to understand the written Torah. It's with any system of law, you need context for the system of law. So here, in order for us to know whether to take that literally or whether it is meant metaphorically, we require context. The Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, provides for us that context. And here you see it functioning, where it is a case of chabalah, which is injury, bodily injury. Bodily injury requires payment in order to compensate. Now, in fact, there are five levels of payment of chabalah. And that is made clear in the Torah itself. The Talmud details it. The five levels of payment are nezek, something equal to the damage itself, the damage that you have caused. Sa'ar is pain. Right? Any court, in dealing with a tort of this kind, has got to take into account also the anguish of the injured party. Ripui are medical damages, the cost of doctors, whatever the cost of the doctor is has to be paid by the person who caused the damage and not by the person who is suffering. Shevet. Shevet is loss of employment. Right? If a person is injured, the person cannot necessarily go to work. In assessing that level of payment that's due, the court, this court of three now, has got to take into account loss of employment. And finally, it's an interesting one that I don't think is in our system, but you tell me, you know more than I do about this. The fifth category is boshet, humiliation.
If,
well, we had that. That was tsar. Tsar was pain and suffering.
Defamation.
It is
of consortium with your wife or husband.
This is humiliation. Humiliation. This is a level of bullshit. If the damage that has been done to you also involves a level of humiliation, the court will put a monetary value to that. So these five issues then, in all cases where there are damages to body, okay, to a person's body. Right. Questions? Yes.
I have a question on this stealing the sheep business.
Right.
So, Al Tignov is one of the ten commandments.
Yes.
So, or I thought those were all like, you commit one, you're a dead person.
Okay, that's a good point. Dan says, the Ten Commandments itself says Al Tignov. Rabbis raised exactly your question. They said, we have these other things that are compensation, but the Ten Commandments says you're not allowed to steal. And in the Ten Commandments, we assume that the penalty is a grave penalty, maybe even a capital penalty. Therefore, according to the halacha, lo tignov in the Ten Commandments does not refer to what we've been talking about. Instead, it refers to kidnapping. Kidnapping, because the only case of theft that could be a capital crime is the kidnapping of a person. And therefore, lo tignov in halacha refers to kidnapping. Gnevat nefesh.
That's also true in our law. There's so much of our law, which I keep studying, derives from Jewish law.
Is that right?
But kidnapping is a capital offense.
There you go.
I have a question. In terms of bodily injury, do they make the distinction between accidental and with intent?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Because accidental injury, you have to prove intent.
Right.
You have to prove intent. And that's a major concern of the Torah. The Torah talks about if, let us say, somebody does not intend to do what happens, it's accidental. That's one thing. You have to have a certain level of intent to have all of these penalties. However, there are cases of negligence, which don't have intent. Okay, and if you can prove negligence, then there's a certain level of obligation that you have as a damaging party, damager, that is required in case you have negligence. And then where there is no negligence and no intent at all, that's the more problematic one. And that will be something that will often be argued. Probably argued in our courts as well. whether we can say, you know, if it's a complete accident, and in fact you have no responsibility. But there is often a desire to limit that in the law. No? Okay, let's keep going on.
Can you just talk about the concept of monetization requires monetary structure.
Correct.
And was that notion embedded in Roman law before this? Is that a creation of Jewish law? Or
well, I think that
it's a huge leap to go. And obviously, in the Torah, there was no money yet.
No, I wouldn't say that. There was money in the Torah.
But at the time of the setting of the law.
The setting of the law, there is money.
There is money.
There's always money because you have, even with the earliest part of the law, where you have the shkalim. You have the coinage paying for the five shekels for the pigeon of Ben. So there is always a monetary system. And that monetary system is in the Torah itself.
But the concept of monetization,
that
making something that isn't a monetary, obviously, has a monetary value, a human's arm,
correct.
Or human's
that's
humiliation.
Much correct. That's it. That's not the same thing.
Those are conceptually very different.
Correct. If in a monetary case, even a case of theft, it's obvious that the setting of a certain value just is intuitive. But to move from there to damages to body, to set a value to that, it's not intuitive.
Right.
That's why I say that as far as the halacha goes, it's understood to be equally as intuitive. But whether it actually was, I couldn't tell you. But you're right, it's quite different.
And is ignoring the Roman law, because they don't talk at all about the Roman law.
No, of course.
So, but is ignoring the Roman law a getting even, an assault of act?
Well, it depends.
By omission?
It's a very interesting question, and a lot of academic research in the last 75 years, a certain piece of it has examined this question. Because to some extent, we know that that's true. For example, Professor Aaron Kirshenbaum, who is a professor of Jewish law at Tel Aviv University, wrote a book on self-incrimination Jewish law. It's called Self-Incrimination Jewish Law. In Jewish law, you have, I may mention this to you, you have an extreme example of the Fifth Amendment. You cannot testify against yourself. So Kirshenbaum argues there, you can't testify, in Jewish law you can't testify in any case concerning yourself. So it's a more extreme idea. It's not just against yourself, but any case, your evidence is not admissible. So why would that be? So Kirshenbaum argues that it was an attack on Roman law. The Roman law had emphasized coerced testimony and used violent means to get people to admit, and that was a basic piece of the Roman law. So the Jewish law was against that. Okay? That's one way of looking at it. The opposite is also true. You have the law in the capital law, for example, the law... Good. Open those. Give us some here. It's too hot. The law of a capital case, capital crimes, the types of punishments. One of the things that is going on now is to compare that to those things that happened in Roman law. And it enables us to understand the context much better. Okay? Sometimes Jewish law is a response against. Sometimes it seems to be another example of something that you have in Roman law. So it's always an open question and a question that we have to ask.
So I understand the need for courts in a civil society, but isn't there a tension here in a religiously based society where almost everything that's identified here is punishable by God? Why isn't that enough? Why? I mean, I know there's a passage in the Torah that says you should set up courts.
There you go. Well, and it also says about witnesses to capital cases, and that a person should die at the hands of the witness. That's what the Torah says. That's all it has to say. Now, if it says that, then it gives courts jurisdiction in order to do some of these things. Of course, the point that you're making, though, is an important point. We will have to try to figure out where, when the Torah says he shall die, does it mean that the court shall make him die? Or could this be a case where God will make him die without the intervention of the court? We'll have to develop some system for knowing when the Torah means one thing or it means another, because there's a big difference between the two. Okay? But you're absolutely right. Those are not the same thing, and they will not always be the same thing, and we have to develop certain criteria in the development of the law so we'll know which is which. Okay?
Well, nope. Even in doing that, you're creating boundaries of the Jewish people by having the Jewish people have their own distinct law, and that also, I think, could be a reason to have the, to have this in, separate and apart from what the ruling Roman law might be.
That's true. It could be in order to create national identity in the context where there are the Romans. And there's no doubt about the fact that a lot of the Mishnah serves that purpose. It serves that purpose in terms of creating memory, communal memory, as well as creating some corpus which becomes the central educational corpus of a culture. Yeah, no doubt about that. Let's keep going. Yes.
I just wanted to add, though, and it may have some relevance with what Dale was saying. The end of last session, you read something, maybe it was from Chronicles, that was very
interesting. Yes, the Chronicles, right.
Because it added another element to law that only the Jews would think about and other people wouldn't necessarily think about, and it was something to the effect that we need to have justice so that God doesn't have retribution on us as a people.
Mm-hmm.
It was another
correct
concept that no, you know, a regular civil law or a national law would not do. And so, in your question about this, it's almost as though we have to judge ourselves and make sure that there's justice, because we could have a flood, a plague, or whatever.
Divine justice would be worse than the justice we could do
right
on ourselves.
Or if we don't do our own justice, then God will bring upon a much larger one. So it's an interesting theological thing.
It's very interesting.
Because we don't trust that everything will fall out. We have to show that we are pursuing justice in order to prevent or offset what would be God's calamitous judgment.
Very good. Very good. Excellent. Okay, let's go on. This is a very odd case. Ones is a rapist. A rapist. Somebody who commits rape. And here, the oddness of the thing is that rape does not mean what we think it means. Okay? When we think of rape, it is any forcible sexual act. I don't know whether it's necessarily between a man and a woman, could be same sex as well, but it's a forcible sexual act. In the Torah and in Jewish law, it's much more complicated. Because the law, one thing is called rape, the other thing is called adultery. Situations of rape and adultery can cross over to each other. Because first and foremost in the system of law is the institution of marriage. Not the protection necessarily of the individual, but the institution of marriage. Marriage is the primary institution in this legal system. So we will get to this, and the Tractate of Sanhedrin deals with the laws of rape. What constitutes rape? What issues of rape are capital crimes, and what issues of rape are to be understood as compensatory damages? But it's not all a capital crime. The capital cases are limited to those cases where the woman is engaged, either is married or is what we would say engaged to be married. Okay. Mifate is a seducer. This is a case of seduction. If a man deflowers a woman, okay, then comes the time for her to get married, she is possibly worth less in the marriage market. He's got to pay for that. Okay? He's a monetary issues a monetary compensation. Motzi shemra normally means defamation. But probably in this case, the way Rashi understands it, it's a specific case of defamation. This is the case where a man marries a woman. He sleeps with her. The next day, he says, she wasn't a virgin. I married her. I assumed that she was a virgin. She slept with another man. Now, this has a certain very serious ramifications. On the one hand, she could have not been a virgin, and she could have had premarital sex. Okay? So there, this is akin now to the earlier case of her losing value, as it were, because of a premarital encounter. Okay? So he, in other words, gets goods that are not what he expected. That's on the one hand. Other hand, could be that this was a case where she was already betrothed to him, according to the law, and in fact it could end up being a capital case. Could be a capital case. That's why you have here a difference of opinion. Right? Rabbi Meir says this can be adjudicated by a court of three. The Chachamim omrim, but the sages say, Motzi Shemra Be'eslim Yisrosha. Case of somebody that I've just described to you, this has got to be judged by a court of 23. Because this could possibly result in a capital conviction. And courts of three cannot bring a verdict that is a capital conviction. They can't convict somebody in a capital case. You need the court of 23.
So how can Rabbi Meir, why do they bother printing Rabbi Meir's opinion?
Oh, always. Any Mishnah that doesn't have a difference of opinion is considered defective.
No, but most of the time it's reasonable, but the Chachamim is obviously right.
No, why? Sometimes they're wrong.
But in this case.
No, how do we know? Gotta see. It could be that at a later time, in a later court, they will see the wisdom of something that Rabbi Meir said that the sages themselves didn't get right. And that's why we always include minority opinions. You have to include a minority opinion because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And even though the sages, generally the law goes according to the sages, sometimes a particular rabbi gains a reputation for expertise in a particular field. And we'd only know that over time. You know, our maturing sense of somebody's expertise, sometimes you only learn over time that a person is really an expert in that area. And then the law will go according to the minority opinion and not according to the sages. So we include
it. Even if we can't figure out what he might possibly have been thinking, he was smart enough to have probably thought of something.
Exactly. Rabbi Meir is no dummy.
What?
No dummy.
No dummy.
He's no dummy.
Question?
Yes, ma'am.
So anywhere the concept of a jury?
Nope. There's no concept of a jury. Absolutely no concept of a jury whatsoever. It's a fascinating idea. I just spent the last 2 days in federal court on jury duty.
They chose you.
No, they didn't choose me. I only spent 2 days, not 10 days. But I was at a voir dire. And I've just been through this in our court system. And to me, since I'm teaching this material, I cannot tell you how fascinated I was by this. Not the first time that this has happened to me, but I am one of those people who loves jury duty. I just love it. Because two things. Yes, I get a lot of work done. I already read, those of you who are following what I'm doing these days, I already read the whole Malbim for this week's parsha in the last 2 days. You know, I'm teaching on Saturday mornings. The Malbim, I can never get through the whole thing. I got through it because of jury duty. Or nearly the whole thing. Not the whole thing, but nearly the whole thing. So number one. But number two, what I really love is the system. The system, when you see the system in practice, it's awesome. Absolutely an extraordinary system to see functioning. And to those of you who have never done this, when you're called, go and serve. You owe it to yourselves. Doesn't matter who you are, lawyers, we all need to do this. You've got to see this system function. It's an awesome, magnificent thing to witness. And it works. I mean, you just see the... It works as well as any system that's ever been created. And, of course, it's a jury system. And that's very different. You do not have a jury system here. And it's the you lawyers know, this is not universal. The jury system is a development in our system of English law that we have, which is something to see in practice. It's the way that's the way we function. Not the only way that legal systems function in this world. Jewish law is different. It does not have a jury system. Well, maybe, but just believe me, it's not what I was looking at. It's a very different thing.
And no appeals.
Okay. We keep going. I got a little bit more time. Let's see where we can go. Okay, we're up to Makot Bishlosha. Makot Bishlosha.
We're on the wrong book.
Where are you following? Are you following the Hebrew page or the English page?
2A1.
2A, 2A. 2A1. Halfway down the page. Halfway down the page above the line. Makot Bishlosha. Okay? Those cases where the penalty would be lashes. Now, in the laws of the Torah, negative commandments can result in a penalty of lashes. Okay? And that's a whole separate area. We'll see it some in Sanhedrin. The whole tractate that follows, Makot, deals specifically with those cases of lashes. Again, don't be so sure that this was done. Right? These are systems that, in fact, don't know how much they were actually practiced. But this is what we have here. Those cases which are liable to lashes are decided by a court of three. Mishum Rabbi Yishmael Omru, and Rabbi Yishmael says, rather, Besrin Ushlosha, they had to be judged by a court of 23. Because lashes are dangerous business. Once you get involved in any kind of corporal punishment is dangerous. And you know the system of English law. In English maritime law, till fairly recently, you had corporal punishments. It was a basic, go to see Gilbert and Sullivan. Basic to what goes on. Okay? Ibur hachodesh bishlosha. The intercalation of a day into the month is done by a court of three. Keep in mind that the calendar
is a leap year.
Not a leap year. This is the month, not the year. Okay. That'll be the next one. This is the month. A lunar month is approximately 29 and a half days. Okay, but not exactly. It's approximately 29 and a half days. Therefore, more or less, if you have 1 month of 29 days and 1 month of 30 days, in 2 months, you have 2 months of 29 and a half, right? Did you get that? Right? 29 and a half and 29 and a half, you can't have a calendar that works on a half a day. So instead, you have 1 month that's 29, the next month that's 30, and you've come out after the third month, you're in the right place. Okay? But in fact, it doesn't work exactly that way, because the lunar month is a little more than 29 and a half days. So you get into trouble every once in a while. Those decisions are always decisions of the court. Always decisions of the court. Because the Torah says in the 12th chapter of Exodus, HaChodesh Hazer Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, this month, this moon, is Lachem for you, the new moon. Now, the force of that saying for you means that you have to decide when it's a new moon. You have to decide. It's a matter of the court's decision. And therefore, the court would have to meet, the court would have to hear evidence, and the court would then decide when the new moon would begin. Okay? So all issues that relate to the new moon have got to be decided by a court. Eventually, of course, this is no longer done. Today, we don't make those decisions by a court. have no such function, of course. We have an astronomical calendar that's a good calendar and eventually takes over. But here, certainly in the rabbinic period, and even when you didn't have the courts able to try a capital case, the courts did deal with the months. That lasted a certain amount of time. I mentioned to you before, by the time you get to the 10th century, one of the ways in which the rabbis in the land of Israel want to reestablish the hegemony of the Israeli rabbis over the Babylonian rabbis in the North African community is by saying that the courts in the land of Israel have certain jurisdiction. Even if they can't regulate things in capital cases, they can still declare when it is the month, because that won't bother the Muslims. All right? In fact, the Muslims do the same thing. Okay? So that was one of the issues. Continues to be an issue till today. Okay? So that's the court of three. Ibor Hashana. Let me just get one more. Ibor Shana Bishlosha. That is what Barry mentioned a moment ago. That's the intercalation of the year. In a Jewish year, the lunar year has 354 days. How many days in the solar year? Okay, what's the difference? 11. Okay, 11 days are different between the solar year and the lunar year. That means every 2 or 3 years you lose a month. Right? 2 years you lose 22 days. 3 years you lose 33 days. The lunar month is 29 and a half days. So it's not actually 2 and 3. It's a more subtle difference. Those changes as well have to be intercalated by the court because the Torah says, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. All matters of the new moon, all matters of the month are determined by Lachem, by you. And therefore the court has jurisdiction.
Does that mean B'chol Sha'arecha? In every town, each court decided when
the... No, it had... Well, that was an interesting issue here. No, in fact, this was done in Jerusalem. And I want you to see here, you can see where it says, you can see the interesting dispute here. Ibur Hashana, the intercalation of the month of the year, is done by a court of three, Divrei Rabbi Meir, Stan's friend, Rabbi Meir. Okay? No, it seems that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Bishlosha Matchili. You start the intercalation with three, V'chamishan nosim v'notnim, and then it's discussed among five judges, v'gomrim b'shif'ah, and it's concluded finally by seven judges. Now, of course, we'll want to know why that is. That's why we have to read Sanhedrin. V'im gamru b'shlosha, but if in fact, nonetheless, they decide with three judges, it's still valid. It's still valid. Okay? Questions?
I thought it was because Pesach has to always be in the order.
Definitely. That is why the court has to make sure that the months work together with the solar year, because the Torah says that Passover is the holiday of the spring. And therefore the court has got to use its wisdom to intercalate the year in order to be sure that Passover will always be in the spring, unlike Ramadan. The Muslims don't do that. They have a lunar calendar, and Ramadan moves 11 days behind every single year. It goes completely around the calendar. But we can't do that because of what the Torah says.
Going back to lashings, I have a sidebar
on
that.
You what?
A sidebar.
Yes, a sidebar. You want me
sidebar.
To
sidebar.
You want me to say something?
No,
you want
to
ask. Oh, you have a sidebar. Go ahead.
Interestingly enough, it was Jewish man, Commodore Levy, who in the 19th century eliminated lashings in the United States Navy. And he was also the man who bought Monticello.
That's correct.
And preserved it.
That's fascinating. Nice sidebar. Nice sidebar.
Does it have to do with his Jewish background?
Of course. How could you imagine that for? Continue.
Single judge courts in Israel, like a contract.